Under the skin. Welcome to Under the Scales. This actually turned out to be a reunion episode, and I'm really, really happy to have two Phils here. Both of them, of course, Phillips, but they go by Phil. One of them goes by Big Phil, and the other, just by default, we call him Medium Phil.
For obvious reasons.
So Big Phil Muller is a Pennsylvania, kind of Philly kind of guy?
Absolutely.
And welcome, man. How are you?
I'm doing very well, thank you. Over here in Jersey, in Tom's boyhood home, you can smell the teenage angst still permeating the room.
Maybe we shouldn't have you sitting on that couch.
I don't know what's going on this couch, but
lots of angst.
Maybe that's where the smell came from.
and Phil Clippinger, has been in the definitely in the fish scene with me for a long time. We've gone to festivals together, and you were one of the biggest proponents of amphibian.
I was a roadie. It's a second career. banker by day, roadie by weekend.
Hey, which one of those has been overall more beneficial to your...
Definitely not the roadie.
Doesn't career imply that you got paid, which...
That's a fair point. There was other kinds of non-cash compensation.
Yeah, well, we might go into some of those. However, back when Fish used to play smaller venues, if Brad Sands noticed that you and I, Phil, and I'm looking at Big Phil right now, we're going to be in the house together, and he had access to the tickets... He would put Phil and I next to each other in the front, call us the Twin Towers, and behind us he would sort of laugh at this thing he called the Cone of Disappointment, where no one could see.
It was like an obstructed view ticket, yeah. Being behind the TV.
And Phil has this thing, like you had this, like, you know, I'm tall and proud of it, and you're not going to take any shit from anyone, whereas I am, like, absolutely embarrassed at who I'm blocking behind me. And so I could last, like, two songs, and then I run to the soundboard, but you just stayed there the whole fucking time.
You know, it wasn't that I was tall and proud of it and trying to be obnoxious, just I'm there to enjoy the music, I'm there to have a good time. I typically would start by turning around and saying, hey, I'm sorry, I see that you're right behind me, and I'm very tall, but... That's the deal.
And my parents were Yetis.
Both of them, yes, actually. But yeah, the Twin Towers. I know that I heard at one point from the band that they used to play Where's Waldo with me. And when it was you and me right there, they were like, oh, there they are, eighth row. But when it wasn't, they would look through the venue and be like, oh, okay, there he is. Because I tend to tower above.
Which one of you guys is taller? I think Phil
six,
is.
6'8".
6'8", six, eight. Versus 6'6".
At
six,
your
six.
Peak, you were 6'8"?
Have I declined? Is that, we are getting old. I don't know if I've started the shrinking process yet.
The tallest I attained was 6'6", so I guess the title goes to Phil.
Nice.
Looked like the offensive line for the Eagles everywhere you guys wanted.
I don't know about that, but...
Phil, Big Phil, you wanted to... explain, like, I kind of had an idea how to introduce us, but you said that you would like to do that for yourself, so please go ahead.
Well, just that, you know, I've been into music my whole life. I love the Grateful Dead, and I saw several hundred Dead shows and was a taper starting in the mid-80s. Was probably the only teenage kid to ever ask their parents for a pair of Sennheiser microphones for Christmas. And just, you know, loved that, and then started getting into Fish. But it's a story of really good karma, because at one point, a good friend of mine, Parker Harrington, who's an old school Fish head, called me and he said, hey, I met this kid, and he loves the Dead, and he really wants to get a bunch of Dead tapes, but he doesn't have anything to trade. And, you know, back then it was cassettes, and you'd have to get together, and you have something I want, I have something you want, and you'd sit there for 5 hours and roll cassettes in real time. And I said, he has nothing? Like, yeah, he has absolutely nothing, but he really wants to get some cassettes. Can I give him your number? And here's where the good karma comes in. I said, sure, give him my number. I'm, you know, happy to spread the music around. So this kid named Brad, who lived in Reading, PA, came down to my house and hung out, and we'd roll cassettes for him. And we'd do that for a couple hours, and then I'd be like, all right, I'm hungry. Let's go get a steak. And he'd go, oh, I don't have any money. So I'd say, all right, I'll buy you dinner. So he would come down, like, every couple of months, and we'd roll a bunch of cassettes. And the good karma comes back to me because years later, he gets a job with Fish. And a testament to his skills, started as the lowest roadie you could be, just unpacking the truck and running the merch table out in the lobby while the band was playing. Within 2 years, he's the tour manager. And the years that he was the tour manager, some of those years, Fish was the highest grossing concert act in America. You know, he just a testament to his skills that he was able to do that and was able to rise to that level.
And we, of course, are talking about Brad Sands. And I never knew, actually, that back history of his entry into Fish.
Yes. Well, he was nice enough, of course, after all that to introduce me to the guys, put me on the guest list, and tell me the most important thing, which was, hey, if they're really bored on the bus and you have every episode of The Simpsons on VHS, would you make us some tapes to watch?
I remember that.
Yeah, which kind of got them into like, you know, oh, is Phil here? Did he bring stuff? And then it was the crew bus.
You did like back-to-back Simpsons episodes with no commercials.
Yep, I used to edit out the commercials. I had every episode on VHS tape. And then it was The Sopranos. And then so for years and years and years, I made them videos to watch on the bus. So.
And I was the unwitting beneficiary of some of those because every now and then I would get to ride on the bus and it would be sort of a Simpsons bus.
The Simpsons marathon. Yeah, nowadays, of course, like everything is on the internet whenever you want it. But back then it was a different time. And to have a VHS tape with 6 hours of Simpsons on it was gold.
So. Wow, that's great. And like you said, Brad, one day, like you were saying, one day he was sort of like lugging around cases, and the next he was the tour manager. It was that fast. And he had the brain for it.
He was good at it.
Yeah.
Most people just know him as the guy that Trey threw a beer can at in Bittersweet Motel, but he is much more.
You fucking tool.
Yeah, exactly.
So that fucking tool hopefully will be on Under the Scale soon. We've been sort of dancing around, kind of like it took a little work to get the three of us in the same room. Even tougher getting Brad on the West Coast, because I guess he's, now he works with Red Light Management, still works with Red Light Management, I guess
and,
you might
and
say.
And Primus.
And he works specifically for Primus.
Talk about stories. Brad must have seen everything that anyone could ever see.
If there's going to be a Fish tell-all book,
yeah, he's going to write it.
He has to write it, yeah. So I think people were worried at one point that this podcast was going to be like the tell-all podcast, but it's definitely absolutely much tamer than that.
You've kept it very, very clean.
I've tried to keep it clean but interesting.
He was everywhere. There were like five of Brad. It was like he cloned himself. And he had an uncanny knack for whenever you were somewhere you weren't supposed to be, you'd turn around, there would be Brad. You know, like Vegas, we would be in the casino about to head upstairs with some people we shouldn't have been with, yeah. And then boom, there's Brad.
Or if I wanted like some privacy and was partying and doing something slightly off the books, right?
Yeah.
And I would maybe sneak on one of the band members' buses, mm-hmm. a place that no one should go looking during a concert, right?
Yeah,
Brad would find me.
He'd find you.
Get out of here.
We were always incredibly respectful of the backstage thing. I mean,
except for
when you were
just one time. I think it was the Man. It was a Trey band show at the Man, and we were in the parking lot having margaritas, and it's like a beautiful summer night, and this car pulls up, and it was this guy that we all went to high school with. And a really good friend of Trey's and Tom's and Tebow's and mine. And so we were like, Roger, he comes, he puts...
Say his name.
Roger Holloway. Yeah. So he puts like an ice cube in each cheek and a lime in the middle of his mouth and then just starts chugging tequila. Going, this is how I make a margarita. So I was like, oh boy, it's going to be a long fucking night. So the next thing we're backstage, and looking for a beer or something. And he's like, come on, let's go into the band room. And I'm like, no, dude, I don't think we shouldn't push it. Next thing we're in there and that leads to like picking up Trey's practice, his warm-up guitars.
But it's still a Languedoc.
Oh, yeah. It's just the one he wasn't using on stage. So Roger's playing and I go, I just have to touch it. Like, can I just touch it? It's this coveted thing. So I put it on and I'm playing and I'm getting more and more comfortable. Next thing I know, I'm like windmilling like Pete Townsend, total dickhead thing. And of course the door opens up and Brad Sands is just looking at me as I'm in mid full, windmill Pete Townsend motion.
He even like did it. You could even see him like searching his database for your name.
Yeah.
And didn't quite have it, right?
That was it. After that, things were never the same.
Well, he had you after that.
Yeah,
but I think he kind of like locked it in right there.
You're here with the Jersey drunk, aren't you?
Yeah.
I think he's like Clippinger. I know
I knew you were one of those guys. I had to keep an eye on.
You're being left off the list.
After years of like watching ourselves more or less.
Right.
It was our demise.
But you know, Brad was quite a prankster too. Brad didn't just catch people at stuff. He did stuff.
Oh yeah.
There's a famous story for me. A buddy of mine shoots bootleg videos, not of fish, but he like does metal shows and stuff like that. And he had shot Primus. This is back in the day in the mid 90s, and Brad loves Primus. So he shot this Primus show at the Electric Factory. I got a copy of it and was like, oh, I'll take this out to Brad. He'd love to have this to watch on the bus. So it was actually Vegas, 96, the Aladdin, which is a phenomenal thing. And just so much went on with that. But I gave it to Brad that day and was like, here's something to watch on the bus. He goes, oh my God, Primus, I'm so psyched. Thanks a lot. Well, little did I know that Les Claypool's there. And, you know, Les and Larry Lalonde came out on stage, played with Fish during Harpua. One of the best Harpuas ever. Probably the best week of Pog ever. A bunch of great stuff, a great night. So anyway, afterwards, after the show, we're in the after show party. Not too many people, about 50 people. We're having a drink, having a smoke. And Les Claypool comes in the room. And I see him look around and see me and make a beeline for me. Like literally pushes people out of the way like Donald Trump pushing out members of NATO to get over to me. Comes right up to me, literally about 8 inches from my face. That if someone got that close to you in a bar, you'd know you were about to get into a fight.
Yeah.
Pokes me in the chest with two fingers hard and says, are you Big Phil?
What?
And I said, yes. Pulls the videotape of Primus out of his back pocket and starts smacking me in the chest with it and screaming, what is this? We have lawyers. There's going to be lawsuits. This is copyright infringement. Is screaming at me. And everyone in the room just goes dead silent. Like their jaws are on the floor and people are staring at him, berating me at the top of his lungs and beating me with this videotape for about 30 seconds. At which point he just dissolves into laughter and tells me, your friend Brad told me to come in here and give you grief. I don't care about stuff like that. And my heart is going like a million miles a minute. I'm like...
Vintage Brad Sands.
Vintage Brad Sands.
That's total vintage.
So, at which point then Les was like, hey, what's that good smell I smell on you? And hung out with us for quite a while. It was ever so nice, but it was a little stressful.
Phil, I remember this, what you saying just now reminded me, and I'm not positive exactly where, but it was a Fish show, and it was kind of a pre-show, and it rained, incredible rain, and for whatever reason there was this VIP tent kind of thing. It might have been like a Man Music Center kind of place.
Okay.
And backstage, everyone who had a brain was crammed into this tent, and it happened to be where there was catering, and there was,
I'm thinking this might be Brooklyn you're talking about.
Okay.
The ballpark,
quite possibly. So I remember there was this little line and for beer, and having nothing else to do in the downpour, I went and got two beers. And as I sort of made my way through the crowd holding two full beers, Big Phil assisted me by pantsing me. He yanked my shorts off. And it's one of the few times I had like nice, new, cool, okay underwear,
Thank goodness.
An old bit of goodie.
Yeah.
But I haven't gotten you back for that.
For the record, it was almost like somebody getting off an airline seat in front of you. You were like giving me the butt very close and I'm having to lean back so I didn't get your ass in my face. And I was like, okay, well, this is too good. And I perhaps made it worse for myself by then bearing.
Yeah.
But it had to be done.
The full Sasquatch ass.
Yes.
And I had no...
And he couldn't do anything. He had a beer in each hand. He had
to like, beers,
that's
kinda,
commitment, right?
He kind of waddled off to somewhere where he could put the beers down and pull his pants up.
I thought I sat on you.
Maybe I blocked that out of my memory wisely.
That's the only thing that you could do at that point. Phil, we got to go back into you now, Phil Clippinger.
Yeah. Yeah, so I mean, obviously my relationship to the band goes back to sixth grade with you and Trey, really, hanging out and just being mutant, you know, adolescents and pranksters and teens. And then I had, you know, this very early relationship with Phish, like 89, 90, going to Wetlands and seeing them and sort of going, wow, you know, I mean, musically they're awesome, but I don't, you know, lyrically, I don't know about, like, I think it was David Bowie. I was kind of going, wow, you know. They could use maybe a little help on the lyrics side. And then I got married and went back to graduate school and didn't see the band again till I think 98. So I went from like 90 to 98, you know. So they went from Wetlands to when I saw them, you know, at
big jump.
At the Spectrum. I think I was with my wife at that time driving to Montreal for like a romantic weekend, and we're on the New York State Thruway, and you know, I'm in a minivan and I've got a kid and the whole thing. And there's this huge line of traffic, like, you know, 10, 20 miles of traffic. We pull off the side of the road to get gas and, you know, and there had just been, I guess, Lemon Wheel.
Yeah.
Going on that weekend. So here I am, you know, pulling off. I'm like in the, you know, the Bermuda shorts and the golf shirt and a minivan heading up to Montreal, just going, oh my God, what happened to me? How did I get here? Like, so we pulled off to get gas and I wanted to grab some of the, you know, the fish heads and just say, take me with you. I've made a terrible mistake. Like, I don't know how this happened.
Change my life.
Just throw me in the trunk and I can have a duo. I want a do-over. Like, please rescue me from myself. But then, so I got divorced and then Steven said, you got to come see Trey. Like, it's unbelievable what's gone on. So we went to this show at the Spectrum and we're walking through Shakedown Street and I meet Steven down there and I'm in the Bermuda shorts again with like a pink, you know, button down on. And he's like,
what are you doing?
Like, you look like such a douche. I'm like, I don't know, man. I'm having a middle-aged crisis. So we're walking through Shakedown Street and this guy's like, nuggets, anybody need nuggets? And I go, what's he talking about? And he goes, and Steven says, he's selling weed. I go, oh yeah, let's buy some weed. You know, so I like put my finger up like I'm ordering, like, you know, yeah, like I'm hailing a cab. And this guy takes one look at me and he goes, narc, narc, you know, and starts like whipping between cars with his backpack, you know, and everyone's turning around being like, fuck you, pig, fuck off.
You're like, thanks, Steven, I really love fish. This is great.
I'm like, I'm off to a great start. I'm like, no, I swear I'm not a cop.
I'm fitting in really well.
Yeah, this is going just as I had hoped. And so that was actually the first night I met you. And you were this sort of tall, ominous looking dude. And I'm like, Steven, what's up with who's that guy that Tom's talking to? And he's like, that's Big Phil. And I turned around and I introduced myself. And then I got to know you as like this amazingly warm-hearted, kind, just very large kind of...
Large, so ominous is, dude.
Large, ominous dude.
That's the description on my driver's license.
And so that was like, you know, getting back into Phish after an 8-year hiatus. And that was the famous Tonto
show. Gosh. That was
where this kid was spinning. He had like long black hair down to his ass and he was in the aisle and he was kind of smacking us sometimes. And he had no shirt on and was like just profusely sweating and like sweat was like spraying as he was dancing. And I'm like on the end trying to protect Tom from this flailing spinner. And I was finally, I'm like, you know, dude, could you just like fucking take it over there or something like that? To which he looks at me and he gives me some lip and I just see this huge hand come across my chest. I barely get out of the way in time and Tom goes, fuck off, Tonto. And just pushes this guy and he flies like 3 feet backwards.
If you get mad enough, you might as well follow through at some point.
So that went on for years, the fuck off Tonto. Though,
wasn't it you saying, or he saying to you, you don't belong here.
Oh, yeah. He's like, what are you? You're
laminate, and you're friends with Trey and Tom, and you don't belong here.
You're right. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, the irony of that.
Set Tom off, or you, or both.
And that's the thing. If you're at a fish show, and you're a young kid these days, be respectful of the older people. They might know somebody. And
you
they've certainly
know,
been
right?
around a long time.
Yeah. That was kind of like the rule for us at Grateful Dead, right?
Exactly.
Yeah. That's right.
So true.
Yeah.
It's funny. I'm kind of known as someone who does not put up with like people in my seats. It's like everybody spin, dance, have a great time, but be respectful of everybody near you. Don't inflict your stuff on someone else. And it's like, all right, I have this seat. And sometimes like when I had two seats, it's like, yeah, my friend who was in the other seat is over there. So now both of these are mine. Be on your way. I'm needing them to dance. I dance pretty big when I dance. I don't spin, but I dance. Tom, I told my Les Claypool story. Have you ever had any odd interactions with celebrities at fish shows?
Well, I mean, I've met Les Claypool. I met Kid Rock. I met Stuart Copeland.
Fred Savage.
Fred was great.
He was awesome.
Fred liked to have fun. He's a good guy.
It might be time for this story. This is kind of one of my funniest things that ever kind of happened to me. And it involves a celebrity, Stephen Wright, the comedian. So this was in Chicago. And I believe Mike had invited Stephen somehow to see Fish. And he's completely one of my top favorite comedians by far. And yet, you know, when you meet a celebrity, you want to say something incredibly smart and you just fumble it. I came backstage and Mike, I think, even knew that I liked Stephen Wright and like kind of spied me coming in and said, hey, one of your big fans, Tom, is here. And he writes some of the words for our songs. And it was a very nice intro. And I was just kind of like, you know. And so I didn't get a wonderful hello to Stephen. But he was gracious. And he said something about one of his jokes that I actually knew. So I passed that test. But my internal organs were also giving me a test of their own. And the reason I was back there wasn't to meet anyone. It was to find a nice, private, quiet bathroom.
Right.
And I really was now urgently needing it. And so I went around the corner, and it was one of these stadiums where it was like a locker room. Like, mm-hmm. You know, it had a bank of maybe 20 stalls, each one immaculate. And so I figured out for maximum privacy, I'll go right into the center one. And I went in and like bliss, it was completely empty. And I sat down and everything ready to rock. And then all of a sudden heard these like steps coming near me and someone whistling. And coming closer and closer to me, and I was like, what the hell, why are they coming here? And when it became obvious that they were actually gonna come in, like the door next to mine started opening, I said, is that Billy Joel? And Stephen Wright goes, I don't know. And I said, no, I didn't mean was the song Billy Joel. I meant, were you Billy Joel? And he goes, I knew what you meant. And he sat down and...
20 stalls and he went
next to me. And we were cracking up together. And it was a really hilarious moment.
Oh, that's funny.
And that was him, to me, at his funniest ever.
What about your Chevy Chase moment? It was brief, but brilliant.
Do you want to tell that one? I'm kind of like...
You saw him like in the lobby at something and you walked up to him and you sort of bumped chest and you said, he draws the foul.
Oh yeah.
From Fletch.
From Fletch, yeah.
And you just walked away. And he just looked totally amused. of all his lines.
Looking back.
Why would you have chosen, you know, that guy's got 1,000 classics.
Yeah. Right. No one ever hit him with that one.
No one ever hit him with that.
Probably gets a lot more Caddyshack than
that. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Which, by the way, Fred Savage can say the entire movie of Caddyshack.
Oh, yeah. Oh, that was like one of the best, kind of the best things. Having you with us when we hung out with Fred Savage. Because when we were walking in a group from one casino to another... in Vegas, and all of a sudden, Phil, this is Medium Phil's probably movie that he can recite every single fucking line to. The two of them were doing Ted Knight, and maybe it was Chevy Chase.
Yeah,
the whole movie almost. Back and forth. Yeah, you guys did the whole movie verbatim, and it was hilarious. Just absolutely hilarious.
Is he chomped on about 10 Tootsie Roll Pops? I've never seen anybody. He just cranked those things. He had a backpack full. Of like those lollipops.
Of all the things that people come to fish shows with a backpack full of. Tootsie Pops seem to be low on the list.
That was He'd have one going before the other one was...
Maybe he was trying to quit smoking or something.
Maybe.
He wasn't trying to quit when I saw him.
And that's when you met another celebrity. Since we're dropping celebrities, that's when you met Joe, right? Smoking Joe. Joe Theismann.
Oh, God, right. Playing craps with him.
Wow.
We hadn't slept. So it's 1 o'clock or 2 o'clock the next afternoon, and we just turned the corner and never went to bed.
Played through.
So, played through. And I was really hurting. And he comes and he's standing right next to me at the craps table. And he just starts berating everybody. Screaming at the guy running the craps table.
He was unbelievable. He was incredibly nasty.
Mean, and nasty yet, guy.
He was also amazingly desirous of recognition. So like when people, like, I remember two black dudes like were walking by and they saw him, like, is that Joe? And one guy goes, "Smoking Joe," and kind of like did a quarterback pass to him. He did like the catch, the, like, reception. He pretended to catch it and like gave him huge thumbs up, and then like said something under his breath to us about them, you know, something really horrible.
You must, like, recognize me, and then I will say mean things about you.
Yeah. Wow. Like, is this the first time you've ever played craps? I want these guys out of here.
Yeah.
And he's like, "Where's the pit boss?" He's like, "Hey, fumble fingers. What the fuck? Throw the fucking dice."
Yeah, you made the mistake of one time having your hand out, and I think the dice grazed your finger. And he went nuts.
He had gone on a roll. He had rolled like 20 times without crapping out. And I hadn't said a word to this point, partially because I was semi-comatose, and the other was because I didn't want to get screamed.
Petrified.
Yeah, I was petrified. And he's much bigger, by the way, than
Pre or post his leg snapping open?
This is way post.
Way post, okay.
Yeah.
Sort of just punched him in the thigh. Be like, "Yeah, take that."
kick him in the shin.
Yeah.
So I was like, "Hey," so he craps out and he's like, "Fuck." And I go, "Hey, that's still a good roll." Oh boy, that was the wrong thing.
You did not endear yourself with that.
Good roll. That's not a good roll. A good roll is when you have this whole fucking thing filled with $1,000 chips. That's a fucking good roll. I'm like, okay, I'm out. I'm gonna take my chips.
You should be like, "Oh, those days are clearly over." Like,
wow, you are an angry man.
It's not fun to wake up to with a hangover.
Jeez. Well, since we're dropping celebrity shows, I'll drop one more.
All right.
Bill Walton. Who Big Deadhead over the years,
yes,
and who I met backstage at a Fish show in Madison Square Garden. It was actually a New Year's show, and was very nice. I walked up to him and started talking about the Grateful Dead, which obviously we both see many shows of theirs. And his wife, much like my wife, is tiny. He's married to a woman who's probably like 4'9". So my tiny wife and his tiny wife had a great time chatting, and I had a great time chatting with him about the Dead. And then he confided in me, "I've never seen Fish before. I don't know any of their songs. I'm kind of worried that I'm just going to be like out in left field." And I said, "Well, first off, they're a jam band. They, you know, like, they can jam. Like, you, it's kind of like the Dead in that respect. You're going to enjoy it. The lyrics..." Oh, sorry, Tom. I said, "The lyrics can be a little wacky sometimes, but you'll enjoy it." But I said, "They always, not always, but most of the time, you'll get a cover song. So they'll probably play some classic 70s song that you'll recognize, and, you know, you can latch onto that." And he's like, "Oh, okay." So we went out, set break ended, and we went out to see the show. And about halfway through the set, they started Frankenstein. Edgar Winter Group. And I saw him, and of course, me and him, both our heads tower above the crowd, and I saw him like smile and then whip his head around looking for me, and he saw me and caught my eye and gave me the big thumbs up, like, "I know this one!" He was so excited.
He's such a huge Deadhead, my God.
And a really nice guy, just a sweet dude.
He's been around, and then I think we saw him at the Grateful Dead 50, of course. He was very prominent. Very prominent.
Yeah, I'm sorry I missed that. You know,
that was pretty nice. That was pretty nice. I'm in this room. I'm the least of the Dead fans. You guys are major
such a
Dead
huge
fans.
Dead. And I remember getting the simulcast or whatever on television, and I was by myself, which is strange. And I'm watching it, and I was so nervous for Trey, Because I just remember we were all so, you know, such huge Dead fans. And I was just thinking, God, this the pressure of this must be.
It's a lot to live up to.
Like, you know, being 400 feet below the surface kind of pressure. And he played and he just was, you know, absolutely magical. And I'm sitting on the couch by myself and I just start crying.
Wow. That's awesome.
Because I couldn't believe, like, you know, how he had self-actualized to that point in his life where the guy that was his great idol with Jimmy Page and just playing. Now he's that guy. It was extraordinary.
Yeah. I thought he brought so much to it of his own. Like, he didn't...
Totally.
You know, he didn't try to play Jerry Licks. He played his own thing. But he really, yeah. I did the same. I saw it on the simulcast.
Yeah.
And it was magical.
It was.
Well,
how many people get to do that?
From my perspective, just seeing how much he practiced.
Yeah.
How much he put into it was incredible. He had a guy, just this one guy who plays piano. He's very involved in Broadway. And Trey said he's like one of the most magical people at being able to like hear a tiny bit of a song and be able to just immediately play it, one of those.
Yeah.
So he was able to sort of, Trey would play a Dead song and then that guy could be Trey's accompaniment. And Trey rented a place in New York away from his home and with that guy just went through song after song after song. Then Trey even got a band, and I want to say I'd even had some I believe it was even possibly Joe Russo at times helped him kind of get into the spirit of things, you know, just as practice and just in a studio, and played with them as well. Plus, Trey chronologically went through Jerry's guitaring and learning and
each phase.
Kind of tried to figure out what his influences at the time were, and then he would go into those and listen to those. I mean, it was really this... It was an epic feat of studying and learning and getting to know and feel someone. And it clearly, obviously worked.
Well, to Phil's point, you kind of got, if you have a keen ear for the Dead, you sort of got the impression that he learned every note and then forgot every note.
He didn't try to replicate.
No, he knew the riffs and he could call on them like when he needed a key riff. He would call on it, but he'd express it in his own way. I mean, it was wild what he had done through his study of Jerry and then sort of letting it go and then making it his own.
My only wish was that they had done more of those shows and really given him a chance to sort of stretch out a little bit.
Huh.
You know, he was very good, but he was also very kind of respectful of it, where you almost wanted to see a little more of his influence. But the people who went wanted to see more of the Jerry influence. It was great for what it was.
Yeah.
And I'll also say, six shows, right? It was all in. They did three in San Fran, or two in San Fran and three.
I think it was two and three. Yeah.
Yeah.
Santa Clara or wherever.
Santa Clara.
And then three. Yep.
And I'll tell you, all that practice really paid off in the Fish Tour. The summer 2015 Fish Tour, those guys were on fire.
Yes.
Magna Ball, one of the best festivals ever. And
agreed. That was such a great festival.
And I say that as someone who went to Clifford Ball and Lemonville and Oswego and blah, 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 blah.
Now you took I want to say, kind of fell off the Fish train a little bit at post hiatus, didn't you?
I did, you know, getting married, having a kid, and real life gets in the way.
You have a kid?
I have a 4-year-old.
Oh my God, I don't know if I knew that.
Yeah,
I didn't know that. Well done.
I'm a 52-year-old guy with a 4-year-old kid.
All right.
I'm running constantly. but he's a treasure. His name's Bennett, and he's awesome.
All right, Bennett.
So, you know, life gets in the way. And I mean, I was seeing like 30, 40 shows a year back in the...
Yeah.
Fish shows back in the day. Now I'm at the like one or two.
You were with like a guy, Jeff, Chocolate Jeff. And what's his last name?
Chocolate Jeff Asher.
Jeff Asher, yes.
Asher's Chocolates, some of the best chocolates you will ever eat.
Old Philadelphia family chocolate.
Fifth generation candy makers.
Wonderful.
Nicest guy.
Wonderful guy.
Yeah.
And then that group, I guess there might have been one other guy whose name I'm forgetting, but Peter Roblowski too.
Uh-huh.
So like whenever, I remember being at Atlantic City and Fish played a show, and by all accounts, it was like, you know, better than average, like one of their best lately kind of thing. And you guys know I'm impervious to this. Every show for me is the same. They're all equally good. But for whatever reason, everyone was raving about it. And then the next one, all these guys showed up. And it was the first time I saw the four of you.
And we're like, oh, we missed last night.
But you're hoping to catch the magic. And I think you did. From what I remember, it was a great second Baker Field.
It's funny, since you mentioned Chocolate Jeff, as he's known, I'll just say, the Astros makes these chocolate-covered pretzels, which are amazing because there's like the salty pretzel with this delicious chocolate on. And we used to bring them for the band for many shows. And, you know, Jeff would bring like a 50-pound box. And Mike used to enjoy them, who, you know, is a vegan but likes the occasional bit of chocolate. But it was funny because we were bringing them in, I think it was New Year's in Miami once, and we got in before the show and we were taking them to the band room, and we ran into Trey and Sue and one of his daughters, who at the time was quite young. And Trey was like, oh, you have those pretzels. Let me have one. And he gave one to his daughter and he said, if anyone else at a fish show offers you candy, never take it. It's okay from Big Phil and Jeff, but anyone else, you never take any candy from anyone. It's like, that's probably a very wise...
If it's round and they call it a goo ball.
That's a wise lesson to know, children.
For sure. And chocolate these days, too.
Yeah, that's right. So Phil, when I first met you at the Spectrum in 98... I turned to Steve and I said, so who's that dude? He's, you know, I have met him. And he said, well, that's Big Phil. He's the original taper. He's like, you know, kind of got this coveted thing in fish lore as being the first guy to really start taping. So how did that all get started? And
I wouldn't
what's the story?
Say I was the original taper. I was certainly one of the early ones. I had been a dead taper for many, many years and started seeing fish. I think my first show was like one of the last shows in 1989. But back then you could bring your tape deck and you could plug into the soundboard. Paul Langerdoc, the band's soundman, used to lay out a patch bay with six RCA lines into the board and a power strip. So you could plug your deck in. And because of that, people would bring their giant home decks because there was power. And right. So people had all this ridiculous equipment that they pulled out of their, you know, their
living
shelves,
rooms.
Their living rooms and brought to the show. But you could do that. You could make great tapes. And that all stopped, I think, at the Towson Family Park in Vermont, when a friend of the band, who shall remain nameless.
Please, let's name him.
I'm not naming him. But
throw him under the bus, Phil.
But between sets, he decided he didn't like the soundboard tape he was getting and started pulling patches out of the board and replugging them into his deck. And when Paul came back from the break, everything was screwed up. And it was an ugly scene. And I think that was the death of people plugging into the board.
The last of the soundboards.
But there's still plenty of those that exist. Most of those are out in one form or another. Some
did his name rhyme with Bill Sippinger?
It was not me.
It was not actually Medium Phil. No. But there are also a number of tapes that I have taped that many of whom have gotten out, many of whom have not. I'm in the process of going through things and getting them out. But one, and one of my favorite shows, is a show which was the very first fish show officially in New Jersey, where they played Club Binet at Sayreville, New Jersey, on October 7th in 1990.
Great memory.
And a show that Tom should have been at, it being in New Jersey, but he was not. And as Trey said at the show, my buddy Tom is not here because he has to go to work tomorrow for my dad. So,
ouch.
So he's not here. Indeed. But it was the first official show in New Jersey, and there were literally 12, maybe 18 people at it. When I walked in the venue beforehand, there were all these... It's like a dinner theater, so there are all these tables, and it was empty. There was one table with like eight people eating dinner, and I said, I have come on the wrong night. I have screwed something up. And then I noticed that the people eating dinner were Trey and Mike and Paige. And I said, okay, well, I guess this is the right place. So there were 12 people, maybe 18. I was the only set of microphones. I don't even think the band taped it, because over the years, Kevin Shapiro has asked me for the tape, so my tape is now in the archives.
Nice.
And it's actually online in Fish In or Fish Tracks,
yeah,
or one of those
Fish
places.
Fish Tracks and Fish.in have it,
and it's listed as a soundboard, and it is not, in fact, a soundboard.
It's just beautiful mics because there's no one in the room.
Beautiful mics in an empty room that sounded good.
Yeah.
And in fact, it was so quiet, and we were sitting so close to the stage because there's these dinner tables, and you're right up against the stage, that at one point, I think like the third song in, between songs, they stop for a moment, and I raised my hand like a good little schoolboy, and Trey called on me. Trey's like, yes, is there a question? And I said, yes, I saw you play that song Stash for the first time the other night, and I was wondering if you could play it. And Trey said, oh, we're very excited that people like the new songs. I will absolutely play it. And they played it right there. And throughout the night, people would make requests and not yelling at the band, not screaming, just very casually like, oh, could you play Gumbo? Sure, we'd love to play Gumbo for you.
God, I'd love to see them do that again. How great would that be? It was audience really, requests.
It was a nice mellow night. And as such, they played Forbins, they played Gumbo, they played Destiny Unbound, they played some Zeppelin. They did like everything you would want to see in 1990.
That's awesome.
Amazing.
Now, requests don't really work that well. Trey has said many times that holding up signs.
Yeah.
If the band likes the idea, and then they happen to be thinking about possibly playing it, then they look like heroes. But in reality, if they are, someone holding a sign gives them an idea for a song, they'll often play it the next night. It's like, it does have to be sort of ingrained in there. For example, if someone held up a Destiny sign,
mm-hmm. Yeah.
They probably wouldn't play it that night. However, if in the,
they would practice it the next day.
They'd practice it the next day and during sound check or possibly in the private, there's like a practice room in the back as well. They might decide, hey, you know what? Someone wanted to hear Destiny Unbound, and they would play it there. And you and I have been privy to some of those private practice rooms, Phil. Right?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, the amazing stuff when that happens. But you also don't want to hear sometimes, because if they're in that backstage practice room and they're playing stuff, that's going to come out
on stage for the night.
That night, and that could be the surprise. For example, Bohemian Rhapsody, I walked by and I heard that. However, that wasn't a surprise because anyone backstage saw that choir was there. People kind of figured it out.
I was thinking of Phil's story. Those guys at Club N8, they probably made $30 that night.
The funny part is,
I'm
not going to say the words mobbed up, but it seemed like a club that was run by people that were perhaps laundering money, might you say, through there, because they didn't care that there were 18 people there. I think they probably reported that they had a full house and made 40 grand. And,
that's a good point.
There's this 40 grand that might have come from somewhere else, but that now is legitimate income from our club. I don't know that to be the case, but they didn't seem at all concerned that there was nobody there.
That's amazing.
Yeah. So does the tape sound funny because there are 12 people clapping? Does it sound
It sounds great when they're playing them and they stop. It sounds like it's a classroom.
Yeah.
There's, this sort of polite golf applause. But I'm sure perhaps Tom will play a 27-second snippet of it or something.
I absolutely will. Maybe I'll even go, I'll break the rules and play a 31-second snippet.
Wow, you got to pay money for that.
Royalties.
That ain't cheap. Tom is paying royalties. Money to bring it to you people.
The union
coming out of my pocket. Here it comes.
Stash, it's good to hear people requesting new songs. You like that song? That's good. I will do that on tour. That is definitely one of my favorite.
Split open and melt.
He wrote it. I think it's slow. That's not true. You know that this song, I collaborated on this song, writing the music end of it, and the lyrics were written by another native New Jerseyan, Tom Marshall, who isn't here tonight, unfortunately, because he's got to be at work tomorrow programming computers.
For his dad.
My dad. He works for my dad. Keep it all in the family here. If you guys have any other requests throughout the night, feel free to yell them out, but at this point we're going to stop.
What you will! What you will! What you will! I see the same!
Here's the curse.
Really? The
Wow, that sounded great.
That was good. Oh, and I'll mention, that is a show that I actually got to know Chris Carota very well at, because he came over to me and said, hey, I used to use those mics to tape the Grateful Dead. I had those same microphones. And I said, oh, I used to use these mics to tape the Grateful Dead. And we we started talking about trading tapes and getting together, and there were some shows that he wanted of mine and I wanted of his, and we rolled cassettes for one another and corresponded through the mail and on
you
the
guys phone. Were like young Dead Tapers then.
I was young then, that's definitely true.
And were you guys in a field of like the old school heads, right? Kind of, did it matter, get, you know, what time you got there to put your mic stands up and everything?
Or that was much, much less strict back then. It was like, you got there, you, for the Dead, actually, you used to be able to tape in your seat. There wasn't a taping section.
Ah.
If you could get your gear in, you could tape wherever you wanted.
I think Pearl Jam does that, or yeah,
some, yeah.
Lots of other bands, if you feel, if you're not obstructing other people and screwing with other people, they'll let you set up a little mini stand. And
we were, I forget the year, it might have been 83, but we had the first, what they called a tour ticket. You could buy one ticket for every show in the Grateful Dead's tour, and they sent you a tour book.
Oh my God.
And they were the same seats. So I bought the first tour book, and we were eighth row from the stage, a little on the left, right in front of Phil Lesh, and we had the same seats in every venue, and we had the same people sitting next to us because they had all bought tour books too in every venue. And I taped from the eighth row, and it sounded phenomenal. But yeah, if you could sneak it in, then you could do whatever you wanted. So it was a lot different taping back in those days.
Right, right.
I've talked about the there's a Capitol Theater Fish show that I videotaped. I told this story online somewhere, but I had a giant VHS tape deck. Not deck, but a camera. And I shot the first set from the balcony. And if you ever went to the Capitol Theater, the balcony bounces up and down about a foot. And so it's scary, but the video was very, very shaky. So between sets, I was down talking to Chris Kuroda, and as I was going back up, John Altshuler, who is now the band's...
He mixes live fish stuff. Yeah.
He said to me, oh, you got a camera. Where are you going to? I said, oh, I'm going back to the balcony. He said, oh, you don't want to be on the balcony if you're shooting video. Come with me. And he brought me down under the stage and out from under the stage and into the pit right in front of the stage. And the band was already playing the second set, and there was no one there except me and a security guard. So I started shooting from about 5 feet away from the band.
Nice.
And they didn't really know me at that time. And they immediately, like Trey and Mike are looking at each other like, who is that guy? What's going on? Why is he there? And they sent, like they kind of made motions to John Peluska, the band's manager on the side of the stage. He came around, came up onto the stage and assaulted me. He like punched me in the arm. He's like, what are you doing here? You're not allowed to videotape. You got to get out of here. And I said, I'm allowed to be here. John said I could be here. John Altshuler had told me that I could be there. And John Peluska was like, I'm John. What are you talking about? You can't be here. And I just kept blowing him off and continued to shoot video. I'm like, John said I could be here. Go away. John said it's all right. But I'm John. No.
That must make for a great tape.
And I'm very tall and just like ignored him. And eventually he went away.
Oh.
So I shot like the whole second set from like 4 feet away.
And it's hard to compel a 6'8" person who disagrees with you to make them agree.
To do anything.
Did you give him the Heisman?
I didn't give him the Heisman, I was just like, I'm working my video camera. Go away. I'm clearly doing what I'm supposed to be doing. You need to go.
One of the reasons I was kind of asking about the Dead taping section was because, you know, it's like, where are they now kind of thing. You wound up, you know, early taper of Fish and a supreme Fish fan, so to speak, super fan. Other ones that I just found out, I found this out because I recently started becoming a fan of Dark Star Orchestra. Mm-hmm. That Bobby character was a big taper.
Oh, I didn't know fake Bobby was a taper.
Yeah, cool. Yeah, I got that info from my pal, shout out, Craig Hilwig. Yeah.
Well, you can tell that fake Bobby has seen a lot of Dead shows. He's got all the motions down.
It's unbelievable.
He kind of looks
like Bobby.
He does.
Dare I say, he's a fantastic and probably almost as good as Bobby. He's really great guitar player.
And he has the sound of Bobby like in his heyday.
Exactly.
Down. Yeah. Yeah. Well, I love that. And some, you know, I'm not the biggest, as you guys know, Grateful Dead concert goer. And so when I go to these shows, I don't know that it's St. Louis 76 or whatever. I'm just watching a great guitar band play. And the two of them, their interaction is phenomenal. And they are a great
band. They are a great band. Yeah. I saw them a few weeks ago. And, you know, some of those shows in like 82, 83 were not...
Oh, the Deborah on fire.
You know. And I think Dark Star sounds as good, if not better, than some Dead shows I saw.
Really? Well,
yeah,
there you go.
Where they had a lull there in their mid-80s.
Right.
Now, talking about the Club Binet show makes me think you guys must have seen some very small, intimate interesting shows.
Actually, near where you live, Phil, I saw a lot of the Ardmore shows.
Sure, as did I, the 23 East.
Yeah, 23 East. And I remember some great ones there, like really phenomenally kind of coming into their own. I think Lawn Boy had just been released. It was like that era. That was kind of like their last of their club days.
I have some friends who opened for them in a couple of those shows. They're a dead cover band. Shout out to the Billy Penn Band.
Wow.
Who they're like, that's their claim to fame. They're like, yeah, we opened for Fish. But nobody knew who Fish was.
Now, here's trivia for, did Fish in their early days open for other bands?
They did. They had a North and South thing with the Dave Matthews Band. They would go down south, and Dave Matthews, who was big, would let them open for him because he had an audience. And then he would come up north, and Dave would open for Fish up in the northern states where he was not that well known.
That's really nice. They would kind of trade. Because I remember early when they opened the Nissan Pavilion, I think Fish was like the second band to ever play there, or maybe even the second anything that happened at the brand new Nissan Pavilion in Virginia somewhere. Meeting Dave for the second time backstage watching Fish. I think he might have even come out for a song. Three Little Birds.
Right, yeah, him and Leroy, I think, came
out. Yes, yeah, too. Yeah, Leroy came out as well.
Rise up this morning, smile at the rising sun.
But at that point, I had no idea who Dave Matthews was, honestly. I still didn't. Lots of people did, though.
Yeah. I remember some of the Wetlands sort of 89, 90 stuff, and you'd go and you'd see Blues Traveler, Fish the same night, or God Street Wine, Blues Traveler, and Dave Matthews. I
mean, the Spin Doctors were always around, too.
The Spin Doctors. There was a band called the Hatters, also known as the Mad Hatters, that were part of that scene that were phenomenal.
Just amazing.
Oh, cool.
So many great bands. Where are they now?
Well, speaking of like really, really early days, Tebow, who's not here, he and I recounted, and this didn't get recorded, the show that we saw at 40 Worth, which is an address in New York City. If you go there now, it's like an office and residential above it, I believe. But at the time, there was sort of this cool basement venue there. And Fish played there as a birthday party for Trey's sister, Christy, and Tebow, and one other guy whom I forget right now. And that one was notable to me because, like Phil said, going to, like in Vermont, you could go and see them and there'd be 20 people there. This was one where they were sort of out of their element.
It's like a private party.
And it was just a private party kind of thing. And literally 20 to 30 people there max. I don't think anyone taped it, but I remember in particular because Trey called me out. I think, you know, we had written a few songs and I heard the beginning of the song happening and I saw Trey scanning the crowd for me. And I just, in a fit of possibly chemically induced paranoia, decided I absolutely did not want to be called out on stage. And I did. I got called out, and I ran like a baby into the men's room and hid in there.
What song was it that you didn't want to sing?
Do you remember? Tebow just walked in. That we were just talking about the 40 Worth show, and Trey called me out on stage, and I ran into the bathroom. Everyone was looking around like he was just right here. Did not go anyway. Welcome, Tebow.
All I remember from that show is going home with a senator's daughter.
Oh, there we go.
Now edit that out.
And he walks in. You didn't
say which senator. It's okay. We can leave it in.
I'm not going to.
And that's why it's being left in.
I don't remember.
Seems cute.
So, Phil, you must have some Fish stories from the early days, hanging out with the band.
Well, this isn't so much early days, but
The medium days.
The medium days. Medium, yeah, because that's what's so strange is I left off with the band at the Wetlands in 90, I guess. Got married and got caught up in all that stuff. Life starting a family and everything and moved to Connecticut and then got divorced and, you know, reconnected with the band in 98.
So you started a family and ended a family?
Yeah, it was, didn't take.
Full circle.
It's a quick interlude. And anyway, so, you know, thinking about great moments and memories, clearly one of the Hampton shows in the early 2000s, great show, amazing show. That was one where, you know, kind of a funny story where Trey was asleep on the bus and didn't want to get woken up. And so, you know, I think that's very rare for him. And the show's supposed to start and, you know, there's no Trey, and he sort of appeared, and
I think
he had been awake for all of like 10 minutes before he put the guitar on. It was a very rock star
that was
sort of thing.
The whole night before was just pure rock star.
Yeah.
It was wonderful.
It was great.
It was in a Hampton resort.
The home viewer can determine what that actually means.
So after the show, we went back to where we were staying, and there was a really fun young woman who had a flute and butterfly wings.
Flute girl.
A flute girl.
Govinda.
And so she came back, and we're sort of just having this awesome after show party. And then Mike shows up with his wife and an acoustic bass.
Before that, just a quick shout out to Govinda.
Govinda.
Flute girl.
Yeah.
Govinda. I just want to say, funny girl, she had angel wings on.
Yeah.
Even after the show, I can sort of see, like, during the show dressing up, they became part of her persona, and maybe they were real. I don't know.
And she looked like an angel.
And she looked like an angel, yeah, right.
Amazing.
And had a flute with her at all times, and from what I understood, this didn't happen to me personally, but I found out from other people later that she would play the flute during the show. Phil, how would that work for you?
There would have been fisticuffs. I would have politely said, excuse me, could you please play that elsewhere? And if she did not, I would have said, could you please place that in one of your bodily orifices and leave the area immediately, because...
It's a classic
Tebow. Tebow, thanks for grinding ice during the podcast.
Nothing will get between Tebow and a vodka tonic.
A cold beverage takes priority, apparently. Jeez.
But she was determined to play the flute, man. Like
she was awesome.
She was awesome.
And so
beautiful,
I had a great,
beautiful girl.
What was her name?
Govinda.
Govinda. So I had a great kind of a suite, sort of, with a balcony, and it was amazing.
Yeah, it was a really cool place. It was a golf resort or something outside of Hampton.
It was off season, so we had the whole place to ourselves.
And we were where the band was. And and so
it was like a living room and a kitchen and a couple of bedrooms. And it was
you
a
were
townhouse.
There, Govinda was there, and all of a sudden Mike and Sue showed up.
And don't forget Elsa.
And an acoustic bass.
Who's that?
And an acoustic bass.
And so there was a guitar there. I might have brought it down with me for some weird reason. And so I think I was playing, actually, with you. And we're just goofing around. And in walks Mike with this acoustic bass and his wife.
That's right.
And he sort of looks at me like, hey, man, you want to, like, play?
Yeah.
You know, and I'm thinking, oh, my God. I totally froze.
Yeah.
And so not knowing, you know, it's an amazing thing what happens in those situations. My mind just goes blank. And of the 1,000 songs I've been carrying around in my head for years, I just looked at him and he's like, okay.
You can only play Dust in the Wind at that point.
So I start, yeah, exactly. Or like Stairway to Heaven. So the only thing I can think of is a Fish song. So I start playing something and Tebow just looks at me like, have you lost your mind?
Yeah.
And Mike's just looking at me. He's cutting the throat.
Stop.
Bad.
Yeah.
I could see Mike looking at you like...
And Mike was just staring at me like, are you serious?
I just spent 4 hours playing with the best musicians in the world and doing that music.
It's like, do you know anything else?
Do you remember what song it was?
I'm going to guess if it was you, it was Back on the Train, possibly.
It could have been Back on the Train, actually.
Like Sample in a Jar.
Yeah, one of those. Probably one of those two.
Julius.
And so then we broke into some Bob Marley and... We did Cry Baby Cry by the Beatles. I remember that. And that he didn't mind so much. But he really wanted to play bluegrass. So we were playing some Dead, some sort of Jerry acoustic
stuff. One of the most impressive things was not only how
kind of, I mean, I don't know how well people know Mike, and maybe we'll get a Mike story out of Big Phil, but he's extremely friendly, and he and Sue sing very well together.
The beautiful harmonies.
And, yeah, and they know all these kind of songs that, you know, after the first kind of chorus go round, the rest of us could sing, but these were like classic bluegrass stuff that I didn't necessarily know, but by the end we were all singing along, and it was really, really, you know, high quality music happening.
Well,
and it went on for,
it was one of my it was definitely my favorite,
possibly 2 hours of a Mike personal Mike concert.
Well, you know what's interesting, you say that, because I was so intimidated, and you know, he has sort of he can look at you pretty blankly at times, and you're not really sure.
He had that
he did, but then one song in, and he became incredibly generous.
Yes.
And he was looking at me like, it's okay, like, just play, like, you know, I know what I'm doing.
Yeah.
You know,
don't get overwhelmed. Just play.
Don't get overwhelmed. It's cool. Like, we're just chilling.
You settled in. You seem like a pro, like, after two songs.
And dude, it was all because of that vibe.
Yes.
Where's the tape of that?
I think it's better in my memory than it probably would be. Better than there's
when you play it back.
I've been there rolling.
Exactly.
It's amazing.
It was before iPhone, so we didn't have the.
But
when
a great
you play it back, it's like 8.1 surround sound, and it's perfect.
And in my mind, it was 3,000
people there.
I would have figured out a way to roll on it.
Where was Phil when you needed him? Where's Big Phil when you needed him? That's right.
A quick classic Grateful Dead story. I've told this. We stayed at the Dead's Hotel one year in Providence, and after the show, I pulled a steak knife off a room service cart in the hallway, and I sliced up my patch cord, and I was able to craft my patch cord and input into the telephone. And then we called all of their rooms, and they were all registered under their own names.
Holy shit.
I had about a 3-minute talk with Jerry.
What?
We talked to Bob. We talked to Bill Kreutzmann. We had quite an interesting evening of chatting with them. But because I was able to, like, slice up this patch cord and patch into the telephone. And it's funny. Like, I listened to those recordings the other day, and they kind of make me cringe. Like, I'm very polite and everything, but you can hear I am insanely nervous.
And youthful.
Would it be appropriate to play the Jerry one right now?
We could do that probably. I could get you that.
Here it comes.
Good morning, Biltmore Plaza.
Yes, Mr. Garcia's room, please.
Mr. Garcia?
Mm-hmm.
Hello?
Hello, Jer.
Yeah.
Hi, my name's Phil. I'm just a fan. I've talked to you outside shows a couple times.
Uh-huh.
Just wanted to call and tell you that was just a great show this evening.
Thank you.
I really appreciated that. And I want to say I've been a Dylan freak for a long time, and I think it's great that you guys are playing some of his tunes so well.
Oh, thank you, man.
Have you ever heard the tune A Hard Rain's Gonna Fall?
Sure.
Oh, that would just be, that's the ultimate Dylan tune.
That's a good tune.
Yeah, I don't know if you guys ever considered playing that. My favorite tune is Desolation Row. I couldn't believe that Bob sang that.
Yeah.
That was just unbelievable.
Yeah, it's one of our favorites.
Yeah, what did you think about the show this evening? You guys looked like you were really getting off.
We had a good time.
Yeah, the sound in there was good, and the crowd was just so into it.
Yeah.
I didn't think you guys were going to get out of there.
It was a nice night.
Yeah, definitely. All right, well, I just wanted to wish you a happy Easter and a good night to you. And,
thank you, man.
All right, I hope you guys have as good a time tomorrow.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, good night.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Wow, that was amazing.
And so was Jerry annoyed?
You know, you could.
What time was it?
It was after the show. I think if you've just heard it, you could hear. He's very polite and he entertains me, but he's sort of a lot of one-word answers and kind of has this, okay, when am I going to have to get off the phone with this idiot vibe? And I'm calling the tour manager moments later and telling him, why are these randos calling my room? But no, he was very nice. And we had a nice little conversation.
That's awesome.
And I didn't press him too hard. I didn't, you know, yes or no questions.
Yeah.
How about Mike? I gave a teaser to the audience, not knowing if you have a Mike story or not, but do you?
You know, I have a number of Mike stories. I agree with you that Mike and his wife are just two of the nicest down-to-earth people. But Mike is also, I don't know whether he is just a student of human nature and enjoys watching people and seeing what they will do, or if he is in fact some form of alien that has come here to study our society.
Something in between.
Somewhere in between.
That's why he kind of leans toward the video side of things.
I think so, because he's a watcher. He likes to watch.
Yeah, because he'd be at every Betty Ford clinic. in every after show.
He would always be there. And
just kind of hanging out watching. Like,
yes. And also, I think the same reason he, you know, rides his bike or goes on a golf cart out in the parking lot and will just pull up to a group of fish heads and not even say that much, just kind of to see what they will do.
He's absorbing, sort of.
He's absorbing, seeing what happens. Observing. But he's done that a number of times to me, like done things to me to see what my reaction will be. And my vibe is that I will not let him get me. I will not react. One of those classics is we were in Vegas. I was in the casino playing video poker and was doing very well. I had the plastic cup full of quarters, which was like full to the rim. It was a couple $100 worth of quarters. And he came by with some friends and he said, hey, Big Phil, we're going up to my room to hang out and socialize a little bit. Do you want to come? I said, sure. So we went up to his palatial suite and we socialized and frolicked and had some fun for a half an hour. And then I said, all right, I'm going back down to the casino. So I left the room. I got in the elevator. I went down. About halfway down the elevator, I realized I had left my bucket of quarters up there. So I turned around, I went back, I knocked on his door, Mike was at the door, he said, what's up? I said, oh, I left my money here. He said, oh, okay. So I went over to the dresser where the bucket of quarters was and I picked it up and there was tree fitty in it. There was like $3.50 in it, like literally about eight quarters. And in 3 seconds it went through my mind, Mike has taken my money and he wants to see what I will do. He's looking for a reaction. And I can say nothing. I can jack him up against the wall and start pummeling him. I can, make a witty comment. I can do any number of things, but I didn't want to give him the satisfaction. So I looked him dead in the eye and I very quietly said, looks like I'm throwing my money away here in Las Vegas. And I turned and I walked to the door. And as my hand hit the doorknob, Mike said, Phil, hold on a minute. And he ran into the bedroom off the suite, and he came back with a pillow, not a pillowcase, but like this big pillow that he had poured all the quarters into in a concavity in the pillow. And he came up to me and dumped them very slowly, clink, clank, clink, clank, clink, clank, clink, into my cup. About, our faces about 2 feet away from each other. And as he did, I very lowly under my breath said to him, I knew you took my fucking money. And he just continued to stare at me with that sort of half smile. And then he filled up my cup. I turned around and left.
But a devious little thief.
With a devious little thief. But, and I knew it wasn't, he wanted my money. I knew it wasn't anything other than, right. He wants to see what I will do exactly. When I realize I have been pilfered from.
Exactly.
That's classic Mike.
That's awesome.
As we're talking, I'm just thinking, some of the best part of this whole life of Fish was the stuff around the show.
Yes.
The traveling to the show.
Getting there is half the fun.
After the show, the weird shit in between.
Post-show, pre-show.
Yeah.
The show, of course, is magic.
It is.
That's the whole reason for existence. So that's at the top of the pyramid. But I'm totally with you on, you're with your friends getting there, and that's part of the fun. Right. And then you're with your friends afterwards, and sometimes you have to scrape them off the sidewalk.
You do.
Sometimes, that's where the real fun happens.
We always made a point of staying in the hotel that the band was in, because stuff always goes down. There's always fun to be had and crazy parties. And I had one time where Trey had come and knocked on my door and said, hey, we want to hang out and party a little. So he came in and he partied and whatnot, and my room got kind of stinky and he left. And 20 minutes later, there's a knock on my door, and I opened the door and it's Mike, which seemed odd. And and he was like, oh, and he came in because he kind of had to, and he didn't know what to do there. And he sat down and we're all sort of talking and chatting in our stinky room, so to speak. And at one point he gets up and he goes in the closet and he closes the like bifold closet door. And I know he's like looking at us out through the little slats in the door.
The louvers.
And my friends are like, what? And I gave them the don't. Yeah. So anyway, what we're talking about, blah, blah, blah. I will refuse to even comment on the fact that the bass player of the band that 10,000 people have come to see is in our closet staring at us surreptitiously. So we just continued our conversation and continued smoking and relaxing. And after about 5 minutes, he had to come out. What's he going to do? He's in the closet. So he came out and he just kind of turned and walked out the door. At which point, my friends were like, what the hell was that all about? I'm like, that's just Mike. That's just Mike being Mike. And hours later, I'm actually up in Trey's room. Trey called me and said, hey, can you come up? So I came up and we're hanging out there and we're shooting the shit. And there's a knock on the door. And he opens the door and it's Mike. And Trey's like, Mike, what are you doing here? I didn't even know you knew what room I was in. And Mike says, and this explains everything that went on in my room. He says, oh, I'm knocking on doors that smell like pot just to freak people out. Gotta go. And he turns and walks away. I'm like, he was just going around the hotel, knocking on anybody's door that smelled like pot, assuming that, oh, there's a fish head in here. I'll go in somewhere and freak them out.
And imagine what like for the sort of freshman, shall we say, fish audience member who's getting stoned after a fish show, and Mike walks in and then goes into the closet and closes it.
Don't mind me.
It didn't affect Big Phil because they had this like relationship.
I refuse to let it affect
where they tried to screw with each other, but that would be pretty darn intense. Speaking of hotels and speaking of going room to room, Tebow and Phil might remember, and this is, I think, in Boston, and there was a Boston Garden kind of amazing New Year's thing. And prior to the actual New Year's Eve show, if you were standing in this particular hotel, and I don't think it was the Band Hotel, but it was one of the ones, like the Omni, I want to say, is one of the ones where all the fans were. Like, mm-hmm. you know, 60% yeah. of the people that were going to be in that room were in this fucking hotel. And it was a skyscraper, and it had one of those massive open lobbies the whole way. And at the very, very top...
I'm almost sure the band stayed there because we went on the bus from the venue.
They might have been there too. You're right. Looking up at night, you could see, before we went to the show on New Year's Eve, you could see this incredible net full of balloons. So you knew the Omni or whatever the hotel is was going to have their own little New Year's Eve party too.
Yeah.
So when we got back, the aftermath of that party became evident, and by the fact that this net, which... when you're on the ground and you look, it looks like this kind of very light net. But in reality, it probably had to hold hundreds and hundreds of pounds of balloons. Mm-hmm. And so when I had the opportunity to be kind of closer to it, I realized that it was like this steel mesh. And for whatever reason, Tebow, you and I had been doing, like Mike, a room-to-room right. party search.
You had a Bible in your hand.
I think
you were reading scripture. You were just opening doors of random fans,
yeah,
and blasting through the door and like making, just yelling scripture
because you can,
and making and making people mad. This is the aftermath of that. So anyway, we wound our way up to the top, and I think part of my game was to ditch Tebow, who's very hard to ditch, as you know, Phil.
Velcro.
He's Velcro.
He's a barnacle.
He's amazing. Barnacle. So I would go into one room. Hey, I'm Tom Marshall. Can you hide me from this wacky guy who's chasing me, kind of thing? And they would go, Oh my God, Tom Marshall. So anyway, made it up to the top floor, and I saw the net, which had been released on two sides, right? It had been affixed at four points and had two quick release bolts, basically. And so when it fell, it was actually covering, you know, it was hanging down from two more points.
Right.
And so smart Tom figured the smartest thing would be to release one of those other two points. Clips. And I release, and the net is hanging over a lobby, which is, you know,
full of people,
200 feet down and or more. I don't know. Yeah, I can't do that math.
It was huge.
Yeah. At least 200 feet down. Oh. And I had to get out into space. Like I had to climb on the flower, you know, the things where you're not supposed to go, which is like 1 inch from falling to my death, and reach out into space and somehow unscrew, I forget. Oh, it was a carabiner. And you had to unscrew. Yeah. It was like a climbing carabiner. And for whatever reason, I did. And when I released it, it was under tension. It was high tension. And it swung down and went all the way down. It went boom and made this amazing sound. And I'm just lucky that it didn't release at the final bolt that was holding it and come down and kill people below. But needless to say, at that point, security became aware of us. And
it's Bible thumper.
At that point, our hiding in hotel rooms became a little more, you know, became a reason behind it.
Noted troublemaker.
Yeah.
Well, exactly.
This was also, didn't it end up with you on top of the piano in the lounge?
Oh, yes.
Standing on the piano?
Yes.
Same with the Bible still.
So I found a couple
Tom.
Girls who were willing to sort of hide me at the time. I told them security was chasing me. And one of them was also a lyricist and had to apparently take me out to her car to show me her book of lyrics.
Of course.
So as did. I went through.
Is that a euphemism?
As I went through. It's not.
It's a great line, though. I got to remember that.
Went
Would you
out,
like to come out to my car and see my lyrics?
Someone said something to me and recognized me or something as we went out. And as we came back in, again, they were waiting for me. And I ran, just like, I just sprinted. But they it was kind of cordoned off. There was no place for me to go. Like, I wasn't going to just stand at the elevators and have them grab me. So instead, I jumped up on top of this table that had, like, brochures of what to do in town. And, of course, they slipped from under my feet. And I did this incredible backflop right on the table. Just boom! And, you know, they had me. They were standing around me. And so I was just laying down laughing, and my friends were laughing at me. And I'm in the lobby of the hotel, crowded hotel, just cracking up, knowing that I was in trouble. And one of the guys said to me, one of the security guys said to me, "What's your name?" And I said, "I'm not sure." And he goes, "Are you a guest?" And I said, "If I told you I was a guest, would you still be impressed?" And enough people laughed that I was able to sort of wriggle my way kind of out. I forget how we got out of that, but we did get out.
We weren't guests, I don't think.
I don't know.
I don't remember how we got out of there.
I used to love to be
just local ne'er-do-wells.
I used to love to watch the hotel staffs at these shows. Like, you know, particularly if you're like at some place, like Stephen and I went to Las Cruces, New Mexico to see, you know, a show at like New Mexico State. We're in some little hotel and you just look at the expression of the people that work in the place. Like, what the hell is going on? You know, the pool is just completely overcome by people like in their underwear and like the holidays. Complete freaking mayhem.
One of my best things of watching people working an event losing their minds was Fish in Brooklyn at the ballpark the night that Jay-Z came out and played with him.
Oh gosh.
Because for the whole time, like, the people running all the concession stands and working
the
ballpark
night, right? So yeah, the first night they were just dealing with hippies
and it was horrible, and you know, and the second night the same. But then when Jay-Z came out, every person working there at every concession stand, security guard, just left their post and ran onto the field and was like, "Jay-Z, oh my God." And the fish heads were kind of all like, "I think I know who Jay-Z is. I'm not really familiar with this song.
But let's dance.
But let's dance."
But
if you had wanted to steal free hot dogs, you could have gone wild at that point, because the concession stands were devoid of anyone.
Two worlds collide.
Absolutely.
The thing about traveling with Tom on these things is you've got to be prepared at all times for something
and
going
for
on. You know, like we were supposed to go see a Tab show in Atlanta, and so we're flying out of Newark, and the weather was terrible. So we board the plane, we taxi out, and we just sat there. You know, it was one of those, before there are rules now about how long you can keep people on a runway. I think it was like 2 hours.
Yeah, we were getting punchy.
And we had been drinking we got on the plane.
Yeah, we literally punchy.
We got drunk to get on the plane. And then I think we're angry that...
Yeah. Was severely interrupted.
The buzz was interrupted.
And so buzzus interruptus. And so Tom gets like totally sort of, you know, punchy. And so he hits the stewardess button. And... I'm like, "What are you doing?" He's like, "Yeah, it's cool, it's cool." And so the poor stewardess comes down. She's like, "Is everything okay?" And Tom goes, "Yeah, we just a little thirsty." He goes, "Can we get three Heineken? And she goes, "Sir, I'm really sorry, but FAA regulations, no alcohol can be served until we're in the air." And Tom goes, "Oh, yeah, yeah, okay, no problem." He watches her go back to her station, hits the stewardess button again. She comes all the way back. And Tom goes, "Okay, 3 Budweisers." And she's like, "No, sir, it's not the kind of beer. It's like, there's no alcohol." Oh, okay. She goes back. And of course, 5 minutes later, Tom hits the button again. Dang. And he's like, three scotches. And at this point, she said, "If you do it again, I'm calling the
air marshal."
And out of nowhere, this like little old lady gets out of her seat, and she's so annoyed at Tom now, she punches him in the shoulder.
She fucking punches
me. She does. She goes,
"You 70-year-old lady."
70.
She's my hero.
Like 4 foot nothing.
I'm going to drag her off the plane, well, like a United.
It was the funniest thing I've ever seen in my life.
Before that, too, we were all slapping each other and hitting. We're like three kids on a
giggling and
3 year old.
But she was our mother. Basically.
It's hilarious. Kind of a grandma decides to finally end my mischief, so to speak.
And she did.
And she did. I was like,
you stopped.
I was totally like.
I think
she put me in my place.
Was this also the site of the famed knee crushing?
Oh no! That was the worst trouble. That was the closest I ever came to getting thrown off. This I was like still like gauging. You know, I was like the stewardess was angry, but she wasn't ready to call the captain and fuck with me yet. I did get in that situation once though, and I think it was with Tebow. And this though, I gotta say, wasn't because I was drunk or anything. It was just because I'm fucking huge, and you must relate with this.
I'm fucking huge as well. Yes.
Yeah, and I was in one of these like bargain basement flights, probably Spirit or at the time People's Express or something horrendous. And basically had to fold my...
They will not be sponsoring this podcast.
They will not be. Folding my legs kind of underneath my seat just to be able to sit in the seat. And as such, my knees kind of had found strategic purchase on either side of the seat in front of me. And what should happen, and this is before takeoff, the lady decides to like experiment with the seat and she pushes the recliner in front of me and she pushes it and it comes back immediately like full all the way back like the full 4 inches and slammed and immediately created this essentially like the worst pain I've ever felt in both of my knees simultaneously just because of the angle. Somehow it just exactly like dislocated both kneecaps, and without even thinking, it was pure instinct, I just slammed the seat with both hands as hard as I could back into its normal position, not realizing that this lady is like 80 pound girl. And she flew her face right first into the seat in front of her like you know, really full speed.
Serious face.
And she started crying and screaming. The person next to her was screaming.
You screamed. Dude. She screamed. It was this whole 5 seconds of...
It was mayhem. It was really... And it didn't help that when the stewardess and I would say one of the flight crew, I really have to say it was one of the flight crew, came down to talk to me to figure out what the hell just happened.
All they saw was you.
All they saw was me apologizing and you laughing like I did it on purpose.
There's a certain thing where we relish each other's pain. That's yes. sort of like been the culture that's, for a that's, long time.
That's fish.
I was going to say, that's like being on tour with those guys. Yeah. Right? You're there as comic relief for them. And
fish
they will
did that to us.
Fuck with you as many times as possible.
Like if your friend's in trouble, laugh, right? Why help them?
Well, this is ostensibly supposed to be a question and answer session, and we've had none. So I have one for Tom.
Okay.
But I'm going to answer it first by telling a story about Tom. And the question is, Tom, do you really enjoy when you are called up to be a special guest and sing with them? And I will start, if I may, while you consider your reply. And I will say that there is a classic show. In fact, some people say it is one of the best Phish shows ever. Madison Square Garden, 12/30/97. That's the show where they opened with Sneak and Sally and closed, I think one more song after, but closed with Sneak and Sally.
Yes.
So many consider it to be one of the finest Phish shows of all time. And Tom was called upon to sing during it. And I remember in the end of the set, the first set, they ended with A Day in a Life by the Beatles. And shortly after that, during the set break, Tom came up to me and he said, I'm supposed to sing in the second set and I'm all nervous and I'm kind of freaking out. Can we do something? Can we party a little bit so that I am calmed down in my need to sing? And I said, quoting the Beatles song, I said, Tom, I'd love to turn you on. So we did. We had some festivities, and Tom calmed down a bit. And then he went up there to sing, and I believe he did 500 miles, as in, I will walk 500 miles.
Yes.
And it sounded
by
like
the Proclaimers.
It sounded like it went on for 500 miles.
Oh, yeah, it did.
500 minutes.
Trey and I were saying Hannibal Lecter instead of whatever the band says, like, da-la-da-da.
Hannibal Lecter.
We were saying Hannibal Lecter.
But at one point, you did lean into the mic and you said, and this can be heard on the Live Phish release, you said, Big Phil, I'd love to turn you on, Big Phil.
And we better listen to that right now.
I'm like, thank you. He's quoted a Beatles song in a Phish song on stage at Madison Square
Garden. I've never had a shout out.
I think you need to play that right now.
I'm playing that right now.
Yeah. it was very cool.
And that reminds me of my very first time on stage with Phish, and this is post MSG. You know, this is when Phish had gotten pretty big. I think I'd been on a few times and done like Rai Rai Rocco, Marco Escondolas, but this was like the first time I actually had to come on. This may have been the first time they were at Madison Square Garden, and this could have been the Uber Demon, Shine.
Might have been, yeah, the Shine.
Collective Soul. And I had the song down. I had like written the first part of every line on my hand. So I thought I was ready.
Because you had sung it 500 times in the car on the way there, probably.
I practiced in the car.
Making Phil and Tebow crazy.
Exactly. They probably heard that song way more than they wanted to. But so when the chips were down and it was time, Phish was playing, it was Harpua, Trey was talking. Right prior to that, I had gotten into the side stage pit where... no one really goes but roadies, and you know that's also the exit that the band goes to backstage. So I was poised by that stairway, but I might have been there a little bit too long because I caught the notice of some of the roadies, and they started making fun of me. They would say stuff like, well, "You're supposed to go on now," or you know, they're kind of fucking with me. But one of the guys kind of like took me under his wing. He's like, "Oh, we'll help you when you go on." And he came up to me and like put his arm around me. "Everything's fine. You'll be fine. By the way, when you get up there, could you give this to Trey?" And I just reached out my hand for whatever he was giving me. It was a 50-pound coil of cable. And so I grabbed it and just without thinking, just put it under my arm, and it was fucking heavy. And I was like sort of probably slumped over, and he walked away. And it was then that I kind of realized that they were all sort of looking around laughing at me. And he walked up to me and he goes, "Give me that." And right then, boom, Trey. Right then I went up and I say, yeah. But it was one of those things like going up on stage, hearing the audience come up, huge scream, welcoming scream, and all I could look at was the mic, and I just saw this like 3D weird image in my mind of the mic. I'll never forget it. And like that was the place I had to do what I had to do. I was like, you know, the music was going and I was kind of trying to smile at Trey, but nothing mattered but that mic. But I was very nervous. But I think I pulled it off.
Yeah, that was awesome. Have you told the story about Tommy? Like when you were backstage, have you in any of the podcasts, have you told that story about you listening to the song?
Yes.
Oh, you've told that story already.
And the song has started.
The song started and Brad has to come find you because you don't hear your cue?
Yes. Okay. Yes.
That's fantastic.
Trey got it wrong.
Yeah, so Trey had said it would be encore and it turned out to be sort of mid to late second set instead of encore. And so I still thought I had three songs and possibly like talking to Trey before.
What song are you supposed to do?
And it was
The Who.
We're Not Gonna Take It.
We're Not Gonna Take It. Oh, I remember that.
And,
sure.
Yeah, Trey asked if, you know, because I'm Tommy, if I would like to be Tommy because of the line. I think the whole thing came up from "My Name is Tommy." You know, "My Name is Tommy. And I became aware of this." Yeah, I just played that on that story on a previous podcast.
We talked about Mike. We've told some stories. I would tell a Phish story, if I may, Mr. John Fishman, known as Phish.
Please.
Again, just one of the nicest guys.
And congratulations, he won his.
And he's now some sort of politician.
He's a selectman.
Lincolnville, Maine.
In Maine.
I've always considered him a select man.
He's a Maine man too.
He's the main man.
He is the main man. But no, John, great guy and a storyteller extraordinaire. If you ever get to sit down with him and say, "John, could you tell me a story?" And 3 hours later, you'll be like, "All right, I have to go, John, please stop." But he can talk and he can spin a yarn. But I have a number of stories about him, but in one that I love because it made me money. He had a bet with the band, this one tour. I don't know what it might have been, 94. I can't even remember. But Phish was always late for the tour bus the next morning. You know, they would have a hotel and you had to be on the bus at 9 so that they could get out and get to the next city. And Phish was always late. He never made it. And so this one tour, they had a bet with him that he would be late. And John said, you know, "I will bet everybody I will be on time for every show this tour." And he had like a $100 bet with the other three guys. And as the tour went on, the bets doubled and tripled, and there were thousands of dollars involved in this. And I was at one show, and they were talking about it, and I said, "Well, I want a piece of that action." So I got in for $100, and the bottom line was that if he was late even once on the tour bus, he had to pay everybody, and it was like thousands of dollars to Paige and to Trey and to Mike and a measly $100 to me. So they began fucking with one another to try to make him lose. At one point, I know Trey was calling the front desk at like 2 a.m. and canceling John's wake-up call. They were sneaking into his room and like stealing alarm clocks and things. They're doing whatever they could to have him sleep in and miss the bus.
Make the bus leave like a half hour earlier.
But he was there. He was there every time he made it. One time John slept on the bus in his bunk, covered up with clothes. So that the next morning when they all got on the bus on time and, you know, 9:30 came and went, and they're like, he's not here, we won. He popped out of his bunk and was like, fuck you, I've been here the whole time. So at some point on the tour, there was a big disagreement. There was, you were late, no, I wasn't, blah, blah, blah. There was some big acrimony in the band, and they basically said, well, then we're canceling the bet. Fuck you guys, we're canceling the bet. The bet is off. Well, I wasn't there. I had no acrimony. I didn't cancel the bet. And I got a call. I don't remember whether it was John or Brad, but somebody called me at home because I was not on this part of the tour. They called me at home and said, hey, these guys are canceling the bet. Do you want to cancel the bet? And I said, hell no. I don't know what went on, but if he hasn't been late, I believe him. Well, you know. So John was like, then great. Someone believes me. We're still on. So the bet continued. But because the other guys weren't in on it, he got slacker. He started to slack off, and at one point, he slept in, and he missed the bus.
Oh,
so
please tell me you got paid.
A couple shows after that, there was two nights at the Agora in Cleveland, and I drove 8 hours from Philadelphia by myself. Nobody would go.
Of course you did.
Which I used to do a lot of back in the day.
Huh.
It was like, you know, people were, oh, we're going to the Grateful Dead. It's like, yeah, I'm going to see Fish. The Grateful Dead are, I'm going to see Fish. They're amazing now. You want to come? Oh, okay, I'm driving 8 hours by myself. Whatever. So... went, saw the first set, went back between sets backstage, and found John and was like, John, where's my $100? And he, so in front of all the rest of the members of the band, I grabbed him by the shoulders of his shirt. I don't think it was his muumuu.
Or his dress.
I don't know whether it was a dress or a shirt at that time.
He has no sleeves.
I grabbed him and jacked him up against the wall and pretended as if I was going to pummel him. You know, where's my $100? And the rest of the band, of course, is egging me on. They're like, come on, hit him. Big Phil's going to hit him. I did not hit him. I let him down, and there was a laugh. But immediately, they went out and played the second set. Immediately after the second set, I came backstage, and John made his way through the room up to me, pulled out a wad of cash from his pocket, and peeled off five $20 bills and paid me with a shaky voice saying, here's your money, Phil. And I found out later he had sent a roadie out to an ATM with his personal ATM card to get $100 to pay me off.
Wow.
In fear of being beaten up, I don't know.
Yeah,
but,
shaky voice because he didn't want the elevator treatment again?
I think, you know, it was all part of the game, but I was glad to get paid. And
nice.
And John shows he's a solid citizen.
John is a solid citizen and now a selectman, so you know you can trust him.
Exactly.
You absolutely can.
I have one funny John story where Tebow and I caught up with them in Austin, Texas. I have no idea. Again, it's like 99 maybe.
Yeah.
They're playing at the Meadows or something. And so we were staying at the Four Seasons in Austin. And it's the middle of the day. And, well, we stayed there because the band was there. And so we're hanging out by the pool. And I was talking to John, and I didn't think he was really listening. And he said, well, yeah, you know, man, the thing is, everything you need to know about life, it's all in row, row, row your boat. So, you know, just remember that.
Like the entire philosophy of life.
I'm like, what are you talking about? And he goes, well, think about it. Row, row, row your boat. Don't worry about anybody else's boat. Just row your boat. Okay? Just focus on what you can
do. And don't, literally.
Right? And gently down the stream. Like, just don't. He's like, you're trying too hard,
don't
man.
Rush.
You're trying too
don't
hard.
Try
like, you're forcing it. Just let it go. Just gently down the stream.
Gently down the stream.
And merrily, merrily, merrily. Just have fun. Do it with love in your heart. A little laughter. And then he left. Life is but a dream.
That's a good philosophy.
You know? And I don't think I've ever told that story before. But, you know, it was one of these weird things. It
sitting
was like
by the pool.
Sitting by the pool at 2 o'clock in Austin.
And
then John gets serious. We're all just goofing around. And he starts to come out with like
some... He's laying some life lessons on
Yeah, John philosophy. Fishman philosophy.
Hey, guys, I think we have a whole lot. Thank you for getting these four people in the same room together again. And thank you, Phil. Thank you, Phil. And thank you, Tebow.
I look forward to making more stories, and it's been great hanging out with you guys. And I think this is, I enjoy all of Tom's podcasts. I think the question and answer ones are great. I think we got to one question, but
yeah,
this is maybe even better than a question and answer because we just got to tell stories.
It was nice telling stories. And even though we did get to one question, we never answered it. So really this
was... we're in the clear.
All right. Well, thanks so much. And we'll see you next week on Under the Scales.